in this region last year. The Rohingya are denied citizenship and considered by many Buddhists to be in the country illegally. 5 years ago, Myanmar was devastated by Cyclone Nargis. More than 130,000 people perished during the storm and its aftermath. At the time, Myanmar was ruled by a military dictatorship that delayed international aid from getting into the country. Now Myanmar is trying to transition to a democracy, and the United Nations says the government has been actively seeking help in preparation for the approaching storm. Dave Grunebaum, FSRN, Yangon.
Members of the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights are meeting in Bolivia this week. At issue is the current location of the commission headquarters in Washington, D.C. Many members argue that since the U.S. has not signed on to the American Convention on Human Rights, it should not be the permanent home of the organization. FSRN's Aldo Orellana Lopez reports from Cochabamba.
The Organization of American States created the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to promote human rights in North and South America. On Tuesday, 18 of the 34 member states expressed support for moving the headquarters out of the United States. The countries pushing the change say it's incongruous for the commission to be located in a country that refused to sign onto the regional human rights agreement known as the Pact of San Jose. But before any change will take place, members agreed to build further consensus on the issue, analyze budget, infrastructure, and other challenges a move would entail. The participating countries also decided to create a commission that will visit countries that are not part of the pact, including the United States and Canada, to convince them to join. Aldo Orellana Lopez, FSRN, Cochabamba.
A judicial council ruling in Brazil has paved the way for marriage equality in the country. The council said Tuesday that it is illegal for notaries to refuse to marry gay and lesbian couples. This effectively legalizes same-sex marriage in Brazil, although appeals and congressional action to fight the change are still possible. The governor of Tennessee has vetoed a so-called ag gag bill, which would have made it more difficult for activists and whistleblowers to expose instances of animal cruelty at farms. In a statement, the governor called the law constitutionally suspect, said some district attorneys said it would make it more difficult to prosecute animal cruelty cases. Matt Dominguez is with the Humane Society of the United States.
The industry's response hasn't been to clean up their bad behavior and prevent these abuses from happening in the first place, but to criminalize anyone who exposes these cruelties to the public.
12 states introduced ag gag bills this year, according to the Center for Media and Democracy, including North Carolina. There, the Commerce Protection Act would ban photography at places of employment and make it a criminal offense to lie on a job application. That bill is currently in committee. Many of these
Attention WBAI supporters, on Wednesday, May 22nd, a folk music concert starring Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary fame, his daughter Bethany, and Rufus Cappadocia's five-string cello will perform to benefit listener-supported radio WBAI New York. That's Wednesday, May 22nd, 6:30 p.m. at the Community Church, 40 East 35th Street in Manhattan. A donation of $25 covers the cost of tickets at the door. That's $20 if ordered online. Your tax-deductible contribution keeps WBAI alive. Together, we can do this. For information, log on to WBAI.org or call 347-670-0637. See you there.
30 years after his untimely death, Bob Marley lives on as an icon, not just in the world of music, but also in the social realm, at the political grassroots, and in the field of human rights.
The true measure of Bob Marley's greatness can be found in the far-flung corners of the earth, places many of us have barely heard of, but where Bob Marley's music and Bob Marley's message bring joy and inspiration to the lives of millions.
Join the award-winning Midnight Ravers on Friday, May 17th, from 12 midnight to 2 a.m., as we proudly present our marathon special, Bob Marley, Prophet on the Frontline. You know it'll be ravelicious, so tell a friend, tune in, and be sure to show your support. Only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
And once again, this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web, listener-sponsored community radio. Coming up next is a very special fundraiser edition of Exploration with Michio Kaku. Stay tuned.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, host of Exploration on Radio WBAI. Every Saturday afternoon from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock, we tour the cutting-edge issues of science that touch all our lives. But you know, these are hard times. We have to raise money to keep WBAI alive and well. And that's why I'm doing a special edition of Exploration tonight. That's right, from 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock tonight, I'll be hosting a special edition of Explorations with Michio Kaku. And we're going to talk about the future in this segment. And of course, we're going to be raising money for your favorite radio station, WBAI. And the theme of the next 2 hours is the future. What does the future hold anyway? Well, we're going to be offering two premiums during this 2 hour special. The first premium is my book, Physics of the Future, a New York Times bestseller. Subtitle, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Lives by the Year 2100. That's right, we're going to have a sneak preview of the next 10, 20, 50, the next 100 years, as told to me by 300 of the world's top scientists who are inventing the future in their laboratory. So hold on to your hats. We're going to be talking about the future of medicine, the future of space travel, the future of computers, artificial intelligence, the future of jobs. We're going to be talking about your future in this hour. So for an $80 pledge, you can get a copy of my New York Times bestseller, Physics of the Future. And for a $100 pledge, you can get the archives of Exploration. If you've been a follower of Exploration, you know that every week on Saturdays from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock, we interview some of the leading scientists concerning the environment, global warming, energy, concerning the origins of the human race, astronomy, the environment. All these topics we cover in Exploration, and a hard drive, a flash drive, with the archives of Exploration will be yours for a $100 pledge. That's right. So for an $80 pledge, you can get my book, Physics of the Future. And for a $100 pledge, you can get a copy of the archives on an MP3 flash drive, Archives of Exploration. And what is the number to call? Write this number down. The number is 516-620-3602. So write this number down. The number is 516-620-3602. And go to the website, give2wbai.org. Now, 2 is the number 2. So it's give2wbai.org. So go to the website, type in give2wbai.org, and you can figure out how you can be part of the WBAI family. Now, to be honest, WBAI had a near-death experience. We came very close to losing our antenna at the Empire State Building, an antenna that allows us to broadcast at 50,000 watts. That's a huge amount of power. I've been on many radio stations that have only 5,000 watts. Our antenna has 50,000 watts and is capable of reaching 50 miles in all directions. That's huge. You're talking about perhaps 18, 20 million people that can potentially listen in to 99.5 FM. So you can see, obviously, that WBAI has not yet lived up to its full potential. The potential to reach 50 miles in all directions with a huge signal, 50,000 watts, broadcasting from the Empire State Building. So what we're going to do for the next 2 hours is we're going to offer interviews. interviews with some of the top scientists talking about the future. Oh, I just was corrected. Out to 90 miles. We can reach out to 90 miles. In fact, sometimes when I drive out to Yale or drive out to Princeton, I just turn on the radio and there you are. 60 miles from Manhattan, you can listen to 99.5 FM. But in principle, we can reach out to 90 miles in all directions. That's over 20 million people that can potentially listen to our message. So once again, to repeat, this is Dr. Michio Kaku. I'm a professor of theoretical physics at the City College of New York, where we are broadcasting from right now. I usually host a science program, Exploration Saturday, from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock. But because of the urgency of fundraising, because of the urgency of raising money to keep this radio station alive, I'll be having a special edition of Exploration from 7 tonight to 9 o'clock tonight. The subject is the future. We're going to bring on a special guest from an organization that specializes in the future of medicine, robotics, artificial intelligence, space travel. Everything you want to know about the future is contained in the book, Physics of the Future. And once again, to repeat, an $80 pledge will get you a copy of Physics of the Future, New York Times bestseller, and a $100 pledge will get you an archive on a flash drive of previous explorations. Because every week for the last 20-plus years, I've brought you some of the leading scientists, many of them Nobel Prize winners, right to WBAI to share with you the gift of science. And the number to call, write this number down. The number to call is 516-620-3602. Once again, 516-620-3602. That's the number to call, and you can get right to our hotline and pledge $80 to get a copy of my New York Times bestseller, Physics of the Future, or a $100 pledge for a archive of explorations on a flash drive. I should also point out that Physics of the Future, my book, is going to be made into a TV show. The Science Channel has agreed, in fact, has been filming a series on the Science Channel based more or less on my book. It's called This Changes Everything. It has two hosts. I'm one of the hosts because, of course, it's my book. The other host is the actor James Wood. So James Wood and I will be narrating and hosting a new series on the Science Channel called This Changes Everything, based loosely on my book, Physics of the Future. Well, what I'd like to do now, without further ado, is bring on the first interview. The first interview, we're going to be talking about the future with the organization that specializes on the future that's going to touch your life, the future of medicine, space travel, artificial intelligence, the future for all of us. So let's now have the first cut, and we're going to have the interview that'll take us into the future, 10, 20, 50, maybe 100 years into the future. Well, with us today is Patrick Tucker of the World Future Society, perhaps the leading organization in the United States that tries to look into its crystal ball, consulting with scientists, engineers, doctors about what the future may or may not bring. So, Patrick, glad you could be on Exploration.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
And the first question is, how did you, as a self-respecting person, decide to get into something like futurology and futurism? Most little kids want to become astronauts or firemen or what have you. How did you get into future studies?
Well, I, as a kid, really liked writing stories about science fiction. And the more you get into that, the more time you spend looking at other people that have written science fiction. And, of course, there's a great broad spectrum of people that live in that genre. And what I noticed is that among people like Isaac Asimov and others, people that were interested in science, more so than necessarily sort of social scenarios, they were actually able to telegraph a lot of really interesting things. H.G. Wells, for instance, in some of his earliest writings, was able to forecast to a large extent stuff like moving sidewalks. And, of course, Isaac Asimov was one of the first writers to see potential uses of collecting of satellites as solar collectors. And he spent he's most credited with his great work on robots and how robots would interact with people. So I looked at that, and I realized that the future is something that that we make all of the time. We spend a ton of our time thinking about it. In fact, recent studies show that we're thinking about the future even when we don't realize it. But a lot of that time that we spend thinking about the future, we're not putting to productive use. And so I wanted to see how I could spend the time that I spent thinking about the future more productively and just get better and better at it.
And perhaps one of the most spectacular predictions was made by H.G. Wells, who actually predicted the atomic bomb and made a prediction about when an atomic scientist would get the secret of the atomic bomb. And that inspired Leo Szilard to come out with the chain reaction and then to write a letter to Albert Einstein, who then wrote a letter to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and the rest is history. And also, tell us a little bit about the World Future Society.
Well, the World Future Society is the publisher of the Futurist magazine, where I serve as a senior editor. And the Society and the Futurist have strived over the years to do one thing and to excel at it, and that is to serve as a neutral clearinghouse of ideas on the future. So we allow thinkers and political personalities and scientists to share in a very informed and serious dialogue about what the future could be like. And we do this in a couple of ways. We've got a website. It's www.wfs.org, as in World Future Society.org. We hold a conference every year. The next one is going to be in Vancouver in July on the 8th. And we hope you can make it. And through the Futurist magazine, which talks to scientists and lay people and anybody that's got a fantastic future-changing idea, and we try to get at the heart of that idea and what it could mean for life here on Earth as it evolves over the next 20, 30, and 50 years.
Okay, well, let's get right into it. First of all, computers. Computers have been galloping at, doubling every 18 months. That's Moore's Law. And some people think that in the future, computers could disappear. But what are your thoughts? What are your thoughts about the future of the computer?
Well, ubiquitous computing and computing, more and more computing power being everywhere, is part of it's an example of what seems like the future that's actually part of the present. We are totally inundated with computer-generated information. If you recorded all human communication from the dawn of time until the year 2003, it would take up about 5 million gigabytes of storage space. And that's as much information as we now create every 2 days. So right now, much of that computer-generated information is stuff you see. It's 900,000 blog posts. It's 50 million tweets. It's 60 million Facebook status updates. And all of that is visible. But in the future, more and more of it is going to be invisible. And that's the sort of stuff that we're creating in greater abundance. Like when you swipe your MetroCard to get on the New York subway, you're creating data about where you live and what time you leave the house. And right now, there's very few people that use that data to any positive effect. I mean, it's just sort of stuck in a system somewhere, and maybe Metro gets around to doing something with it. But imagine a future in the next 10 or 20 or 30 years where all of the little bits of data that you create almost unconsciously when you swipe your magnetic access card to get into your building, when you get off the train in Washington, D.C., and you leave a record of when you got on and when you got off and what you like to see. Imagine all of that being used to predict patterns of behaviors for millions of people so that resources could be allocated more efficiently to where people actually use them. You know, Google CEO Eric Schmidt said that the perfect search engine is something that anticipates what you're going to search for before you search it. So take that same principle, apply it to the future of computers as they exist outside in three-dimensional space, not just in the box on your desk, and imagine coming into contact with cars and stores and weight scales and other objects that are actually working with other objects to anticipate your needs and deliver what you want before you know you want it.
Okay, well, let's take it apart one at a time. Mention cars, and in the future, won't cars literally drive themselves?
Well, self-driving cars are actually already here. In 2007, the third competition of the DARPA Grand Challenge, they hold a self-driving car competition from time to time since 2005, they showed that a car without a driver could navigate 60 miles of urban area in less than 6 hours while obeying all the traffic laws and regulations. The winner was a joint effort by Carnegie Mellon University and General Motors. So 60 miles in 6 hours doesn't sound like much, but it's a huge improvement over the original self-driving robot that MIT was working with in 1979, which needed 6 hours to travel just 1 meter. You can see how far we've come since then. There's a lot of firms like Boston Dynamics and Stanford, and of course iRobot, which is Rodney Brooks's corporation, that makes self-driving vehicles to some extent, and they're used right now in by the military, mostly in an experimental setting, not so much in a battlefield. But this is something that the military is looking to do with drone technology, is leverage it less towards sort of combat operations and more towards transport, things like that, and supply-side things. So I think you're going to see self-driving cars moving objects and moving supplies in a civilian setting long before you're going to see cars actually driving people, because cars can move objects and supplies without a human driver pretty easily. But when you tell the car's computer that it's all of a sudden got to think about the needs and all of the different weaknesses of the pushy, demanding little organism in the back seat that is the human, you increase the complexity level of that job exponentially.
Okay, so if cars begin to drive themselves, what about the house when you come home? What's the home going to look like? Are you going to be able to talk to the walls and basically have the walls become intelligent?
Well, this is something that a lot of different labs have been looking at, how to make, what does it mean to have a smart house? And a lot of people say, yes, that what you want in a smart house is a house that interacts with you through sensors, through different interfaces that you're coming in contact with. So you walk into a bathroom, for instance, and your bathroom mirror reads a lot of your reads your weight, but it's also looking at your protein levels, your sodium levels, your vitamin levels, and it's going to give you a recommendation about what you should eat over the course of the day, and that's before you even leave the house. All that information is something that your mirror or your sink or your bathroom floor is able to pick up and tell you about. But there are other ideas for a smart house, too. The Georgia Tech smart house is one where it's mostly for older people, but it records what you do as you go about your day. So if you forgot where you put something or if you need help, the house picks up on it, and they can show you a little movie of where you put the object that you laid down somewhere. And if you need help, then it picks up on that as well, and it can contact your family or it can contact a medical service provider and let them know. They can even monitor the levels of pollen and other particulate matter in your house so that you know that the particulate matter in your house or the pollen is a little high and you should go outside for a walk.
Okay. Now, some people think that when you relax, you'll simply put on contact lenses, which will have the internet, and you'll be able to simply download any movie, download what's happening at the office. You can word process just in the privacy of your room because you have basically the entire internet in your contact lens. Could you elaborate?
This is also it's a really interesting idea that you can put a contact lens or some sort of special glasses on and just sort of envelop yourself in another world. And no one is quite sure yet how to do it. There's University of Washington prototype design for LEDs embedded in a contact lens that you can look at, and you can sort of get light displays. But making the image that small is still something that's really hard. I think that first you're going to see special glasses that you can put on and get a sort of visual readout of, and we're actually going to be hopefully debuting a set of those at the conference in July in Vancouver. It's a Motorola headset, and it's got a little sort of viewfinder type apparatus on the side, and you look through it, and you can watch a movie sort of play out like that. But in the future, I don't see any reason necessarily why you wouldn't be able to take a pair of contact lenses that had the same technology as you see in a flat screen, but on a much smaller scale, possibly on a nanoscale, and stick them in your eyes with a pair of headphones and be watching a movie while it looks like you're paying very close attention to whoever you're talking to.
And won't it be somewhat similar to the holodeck of Star Trek or maybe even The Matrix, being able to recreate objects all around you? You couldn't touch them, of course, because they're just images inside your contact lens. But you could resurrect the whole Roman Empire right in your living room, right?
Well, you could. You would. You might need to wear sort of special gloves that would be measuring your hand movements. But this is also something that people are beginning to work with now. And one of the uses of these special gloves that sense touch, and they use that data the way you when you operate a mouse collects data about the movement of the mouse and it turns it into a display change. There are gloves that do the same thing, and people use them in New York during disco shows to make interesting light shows and things like that. And I think that there'll be tremendous demand for them. The technology isn't particularly advanced at all. And one of the great things about it is it gets you out of your chair. So you can operate, the entire world sort of becomes your interface. So you can create graphics and create displays and manipulate data and open email with a wave of your hand wherever you are, and it gets you up and moving. So I think there'll be tremendous demand for them, and I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing those sorts of objects on the market fairly soon.
And you're listening to a special edition of Explorations. Usually, Explorations with Dr. Michio Kaku is heard on Saturday from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock. But because of the urgency of the fundraising situation, because of the fact that we are hanging in there with our fingernails, I decided to come in and try to help raise money for this radio station. And there are two premiums that we're going to be offering in this two-hour special edition of Exploration from 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock, all based on the future. The first is my book, The Physics of the Future. It's a New York Times bestseller, and my publisher has been generous enough to donate copies of the book for use during this fundraising drive. Once again, the book, Physics of the Future, hit the New York Times bestseller list, and the subtitle is, quote, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Lives by the Year 2100. Have you ever thought to yourself, what will medicine look like 10, 20, 50 years from now? What about space travel? What about computers, robots? What about the job market? How will we live? How will we prosper in the future? Well, I've had the privilege of being able to interview over 300 of the world's top scientists for the Science Channel, the Discovery Channel, BBC Television. And I've had the privilege of taking a film crew right into their laboratories to show you the robots of the future, to show you what computers will look like in the future. What will the internet look like 10, 20 years from now? Find out by getting a copy of the book, Physics of the Future, yours for an $80 pledge. And then for a $100 pledge, we'll get you a flash drive with previous editions of Explorations that airs on Saturdays from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock. So once again, get to the phones now and call the number, 516-620-3602. Once again, write this number down, 516-620-3602. And for $80, you can get a copy of my book, Physics of the Future. For $100, you can get an archive of previous programs on Exploration on a flash drive that then you can play on a computer or any device that plays MP3. And another thing, let's say you know somebody whose birthday is coming up, or maybe you know a child who's just beginning to show an interest in science, or maybe you've always had this question about this great universe of ours. This book and these tapes are for you. Wouldn't it be a great present? The gift of knowledge. The gift of knowledge that you can give to a young person by getting a copy of Physics of the Future. Once again, it spent like 6 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. It's a book that is the most authoritative book about your future. How will we live? Do you know someone who's sick, for example? Do you know someone who has cancer, someone who has Alzheimer's? Do you want to know what the latest is concerning how science is attacking some of these illnesses? Or let's say you're looking for a job, but you don't want to go back to college and learn a dead-end skill. Let's face it, a lot of skills today are going to be gone in the future. So why bother to go back to college to learn a discipline that has no future? Why not find out where the jobs are going to be in the future? That's where this book comes in. This book comes in to people who want to know what the future of medicine is going to be like, what the future of the job market is going to be like, or you're a space travel buff, you want to know what's out there in outer space, or maybe you're a techno geek and you want to know what computers will look like. For example, as you heard in the interview, within about 10-15 years, the internet will be in your contact lens. Therefore, you simply blink and you will be online. If you want to know what somebody is talking about and they're speaking Spanish to you, you'll see subtitles underneath their image as they speak Chinese, Spanish, Hungarian to you. And if you want to know who they are, their biography will appear right next to their image, all in your contact lens. This is not science fiction. This is not Hollywood, the movie The Matrix. This is reality, because there are prototypes of this already, and 10-plus years, it'll hit the market, and of course, it'll change everything. Well, why not give the gift of knowledge to a loved one? Why not give the gift of knowledge to someone who's just beginning to show an interest in science? Why not give this book to someone who wants to know what's around the corner? Once again, an $80 pledge will get you a copy of Physics of the Future. A $100 pledge will get you a copy of Exploration. And another thing, and that is WBAI survives by the skin of its teeth. We had a near-death experience. We almost lost the tower at the top of the Empire State Building, a tower that allows us to broadcast 90 miles in all direction with a huge signal, 50,000 watts. I've been on many radio programs that only have 5,000 watts. We have 10 times that power. And wouldn't it be a shame to lose that if we cannot pay our bills? Let's do a science experiment. Let's not pay your rent this month. Let's see how far you can go if you don't pay your rent in a month. Well, hey, that's the situation that WBAI faces. We have to pay our rent, too. Our rent to the landlord, our rent to the Empire State Building. And we don't have the luxury of going to small claims court and arguing whether or not we're a sad case that deserves a break. We just get thrown out. Simple as that. And that's why you should call 516-620-3602 and pledge to keep your favorite radio station alive. Because we're barely hanging in there. We've downsized facilities. We're hanging in there because of the dedication of our staff, our volunteers. We're hanging in there, but not by much. And another thing, I don't get one dime from this radio station. I pay for all the travel, all the interviews, all the tapes, all the facilities, all the equipment. I pay for it all myself because I believe in this radio station. The question is, do you? Do you believe in this radio station? If you do, get to the phones and call 516-620-3602. Once again, for an $80 pledge, you get a copy of Physics of the Future, the definitive guide about the next 10, 20, 50, the next 100 years. And a $100 pledge will get you the archives of Exploration. Every Saturday from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock for 1 hour, we interview Nobel Prize winners, directors of major laboratories, scientists that are on the cutting edge of scientific progress, talking about the future of medicine, space travel, astronomy, robots, artificial intelligence, all of that on a flash drive, and it's yours for a $100 pledge. Okay, well, once again, this is a special edition of Exploration. We started at 7, we're going on to 9, and we want to raise some money for WBAI. But before we continue, let's go back to an interview with Patrick Tucker. Let's go back to the next segment of the interview. He's with the World Future Society, the number one society that's thinking about your future. So let's now continue with the interview with Patrick Tucker from the World Future Society. Now, you mentioned the smart house and the fact that your bathroom will be able to sense your the state of your body fluids, and give you a readout of your health. But couldn't it also give you the first indication that there's a cancer growing inside your body? Cancer cells emit proteins, enzymes, certain markers that can be detected by what are called DNA chips. Chips made by Silicon Valley that home in on not data, but individual proteins and enzymes and cells. Now, if that's true, couldn't your toilet actually alert you to the presence of a cancer colony that in 10 years could become a tumor, and the word tumor could disappear from the English language?
Well, I certainly hope so. Right now, if you care to put a microchip actually inside your body instead of through an interface like a bathroom mirror, I don't think that would necessarily be hard to do. Whether or not that chip was able to catch the proteins in advance is a different subject. But I've got a friend who he has a microchip in his chest, and it monitors his heart rate. It's not a pacemaker. It doesn't send a jolt of electricity to the heart if there's a cardiac irregularity. It's actually monitoring his heartbeat and sending that information to his cardiologist, and so his cardiologist can check it on a phone. So there's no reason why you couldn't have the same thing to monitor, say, abnormalities in protein levels and send that to if you were, say, a cancer survivor and you were worried about getting a protein buildup that might turn into a polyp or something like that, have that information sent to your cancer doctor so then they could have that information with them all the time. It's not a huge leap in the technology. It's really a question of usage. How much monitoring equipment do we want near us all the time? Right now we're a little resistant to the idea of little devices monitoring what we do and sending that information somewhere, collecting it, and broadcasting it to the world. But as we begin to realize the benefits of constant health monitoring and early prevention and early detection of things like cancer, like you said, I think that you're going to see much more demand for those types of monitoring services. And they could theoretically be external to the body. I don't see a reason why they couldn't, but no one has yet made a device that can pick up protein levels that isn't physically attached to the organism that it's monitoring.
Well, if you have a smart toilet with DNA chips in it, capable of picking up enzymes, proteins, even individual cancer cells, that could really change the way we view cancer. Take a look at Aretha Franklin. She has pancreatic cancer. Steve Jobs has pancreatic cancer. And usually it's thought to be very aggressive, inevitably fatal after a few years. But then scientists analyzed it and found out that it's the opposite. It takes about 20 years for pancreatic cancer to grow. And only in the last few years do you feel it and you go to the doctor. So we could be witnessing a revolution in cancer therapy, right? If you get advance warning, 20 years warning that you might get pancreatic cancer.
Yes, and in that instance, I guess that the sensor would be looking at basically your stool sample and letting you know, reminding you of what you've eaten and what's inside your body right after the fact. And this is the thing that we're discovering about a lot of the illnesses that we treat and we run across on a daily basis, is that they're with us for a long time. And when your method of detecting that stuff is to go into a doctor's office once a year or twice a year, then you really increase the chances of missing something. But when you can, if you've got a device in your house that can take those sorts of measurements for you constantly and alert you, the second there's an abnormality, you can catch it much quicker. And this is the sort of stuff that we're going to use to be much healthier. And this is part of the reason why many futurists predict that we're going to weed out these illnesses like cancer, like perhaps even Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, and we're going to live and be much healthier in the future and live a great deal longer. Some people say that we can live perhaps as long as 300 years with the aid of technology and various nanotechnologies. So we'll be living much longer than we are today. I think that the natural lifespan of the human body, pushed to its furthest extent without a technology to sort of augment human life functioning, is about 150 years. But that's not necessarily the limit when you bring in technologies like nanotechnology.
Okay, well, let's finish up the train of thought that we had before on cancer. I heard that recently you can put DNA chips in your bathroom mirror so that you blow on the mirror. You just say, ha, to the mirror. It picks up water droplets and looks for a mutated P53 gene, which is implicated in 50% of all common cancers. And instead of waiting weeks, within a matter of minutes, your bathroom mirror will tell you whether or not you have lung cancer. So this is going to change everything, right? Every time you go to the bathroom without even thinking about it, you just do your normal daily affairs, your bathroom will tell you that you have to watch out for lung cancer in the coming years.
Right. So you've got a bathroom mirror that you're interacting with. You've got also a scale. You possibly have items in your house that you drink out of that are collecting different samples from your body that way. And, yeah, you're going to know what's going on in your body a lot sooner than anybody else. And this is going to, I think, really empower people to take a different direction in their health because, you know, the warning from your bathroom mirror not to smoke or, you know, to regulate your diet a little bit better or to get exercise is useless if you don't follow the advice. But with that daily reminder, I think you're going to start seeing changes in behavior in people. And you're going to start seeing people getting more regular checkups because, I mean, you don't necessarily have early onset cancer because your bathroom mirror tells you so. But if your bathroom mirror tells you so, you're much more likely to go in and get a regular screen. And that's what's going to help catch the cancer early and catch, you know, other diseases and abnormalities early. So it's really about sensors that we already have, making them, using them in different places, and collecting data about the human body on a constant daily basis, and then leveraging that information to help people know what's going on with them a lot sooner so they can take preventative action a lot earlier. And that does change everything. That improves the human lifespan.
Okay, and talk about increasing the lifespan of humans. We talked about cancers. Now let's talk about organ replacement and growing organs of the body so that we will not die of organ failure. So right now at Wake Forest University, scientists there can take cells of your own body and grow noses, ears, skin, blood, blood vessels, heart valves, bladders, windpipes now, and maybe even livers and the pancreas in the coming years. So do you foresee a time in the coming decades when we're going to have a human body shop? And as organs begin to wear out, we'll simply replace them, and that alone will begin to increase the human lifespan.
Oh, absolutely. You know, earlier this year at the TED conference in California, a doctor brought out a device and was able to actually, in talking to a large auditorium of people, print a human kidney on stage. So, I mean, they printed it the same way when you print a document, you're layering ink on top of paper. This device layers cells on top of cells in a pattern that, in the end, manifests in a kidney that could be surgically implanted in someone tomorrow. It's not necessarily going to match that person's DNA because that was just an example. But this technology really is already here. And so what you see is a lot of people that before would have trouble getting organ donations, suddenly their lifespan and their health outcomes really open up tremendously. But this is something that, though not in wide use, really is in the present already. It's really marvelous stuff. We're able to do this because we have a much better understanding about how to link these sorts of, how to create genetically and blood-friendly organs for immediate implantation. We've gotten much better at that. We're much better at creating objects that the body isn't going to reject and helping people through the process of getting their body to accept foreign organs and things like that. And we're much better at using biological material to create more biological material that is useful. And that only increases in the next 10 to 20 years.
And you're listening to a special edition of Explorations with Dr. Michio Kaku. I'm Michio Kaku, and every Saturday from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock, I host a science program that brings you Nobel laureates, directors of major laboratories, cutting-edge science right to your living room. However, because of the dire financial situation, I volunteer to come in tonight from 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock to raise funds for WBAI. You know, we had a near-death experience. We were almost kicked off the air, and we're still hanging in there with our fingernails. And we have to make sure that we can raise funds to keep this radio station alive, or else we're not going to be able to pay the staff, we're not going to be able to pay the bills, and WBAI will be history. And then to buy back the license, forget it. There's no way we can get it back again. And that's why we need you. You are the cavalry. You are our lifeblood. It's your dollars that keep WBAI alive and well. We don't get money from aerospace. We don't get money from petrochemical industry. We don't get money from the banks. We get money from you because we provide a service for you. However, The service can only exist if you are willing to pay for it, because we have real bills to pay here. We have to pay for the rent. We got to pay for the rent, the antenna at the top of the Empire State Building. We got to pay for staff. We got to pay for all these expenses. And one day when the money doesn't come anymore, well, we get evicted. We can't pay the staff, and WBAI is in the history books. We don't want that to happen. And that's why we want you now to get to the phones. Call 516-620-3602. Once again, write that number down, 516-620-3602, and say, I believe in WBAI. I believe in the mission of this station, and I believe that WBAI should be kept alive, healthy, and well. And that's why I'm going to pledge. We want you to take out your MasterCard, American Express, or Visa, and make that commitment. Maybe you're not the kind of person who can go out to the barricades and protest or hand out leaflets. Maybe you don't got the time and the effort, but you do got the effort and the time to take out your credit card and say, I believe in the mission of listener-sponsored free speech WBAI radio. Call 516-620-3602 for an $80 pledge. You can get a copy of my book. It's a New York Times bestseller, Physics of the Future. It's your future we're talking about, the future of jobs, the future of the economy, the future of space travel, medicine, artificial intelligence, all of that in my book, Physics of the Future, yours for $80. And for a $100 pledge, you can get a copy of previous editions of Explorations. Once again, I'm on every Saturday from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock interviewing the top scientists about the environment, about nuclear energy, about space travel, astronomy, this gorgeous universe that we live in. That's a $100 pledge. You get the archives on a flash drive, so you can listen to it on your PC or any device that plays MP3. And so once again, we now have to call out the cavalry. We want you to call 516-620-3602. And in addition, maybe you know somebody, a loved one, who's interested in these things and wants to know more about what's coming into the future. Maybe you know a child who's just beginning to learn about these things in school and is fascinated but has no one to guide them, no book to tell them what's in store in the future. Or maybe just shooting the breeze with some people at work, and all of a sudden someone's talking about the future and you are clueless. You don't got a clue as to what's coming down the pike. Well, this is why we want you now to call 516-620-3602 and give the gift of the future to a loved one or to yourself because you are curious. Or let's say you're looking for a job and you want to go back to junior college or a city college and you realize that, hey, why should I go back to school and learn something that's going to be obsolete as soon as I graduate? I'm going to be ahead of the curve, not behind the curve. And so if you want to know where the jobs are going to be, what kind of jobs that are doomed, what kind of jobs are going to go out the window, what kind of jobs that are like the blacksmiths and wagon makers of old, well, get a copy of my book, Physics of the Future, because I had a chance to interview the economists who tell us that the economy is changing. And unless you change with the economy, you're going to graduate right into the unemployment line. And so for all these reasons, you may want to call 516-620-3602. An $80 pledge will get you a copy of Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Lives by the Year 2100. And a $100 pledge will get you a copy of Explorations, an archive on MP3. And let me say something else. You may say that science is a luxury. It's kind of pretty to think about these things, but hey, what's it got to do with me? Let me tell you what's it got to do with you. Science is the engine of wealth. All the wealth that we see around us comes originally from science. But ask yourself a question. Why are some nations poor? Why are some nations just scratching by while other nations are just rolling in the bucks? Is it magic? Does money grow from trees? Is that the secret of wealth? Well, let me tell you something. If you were an alien coming down to visit the Earth 500 years ago, and you were to see the Europeans, the Chinese, and the Muslims, who would you say would eventually rise to dominate the Earth? It's a no-brainer. 500 years from now, you'd say, of course, the Chinese, or maybe the Muslims. And the last would be the Europeans. What were the Europeans doing 500 years ago? They wanted to burn Galileo. They were burning witches. They had the Inquisition. They were torturing scientists. Europe was the last place where you would think you would have prosperity and wealth. But what happened? What happened 500 years ago? Why did it change? Why did all of a sudden Europe soar ahead while China and the Muslim countries stagnate? Well, what happened was 500 years ago, the Chinese built a fleet of boats that went around the world, bringing all the riches and information about other societies back to the capital. And we have woodcuts of giraffes and exotic African animals being paraded before the emperor. Think about that. And then, according to the story, the emperor said, "Is that all? Is that all? Just elephants and giraffes? Where are the great empires to challenge Imperial China? Nowhere. We're number one." And what did the emperor do? He burned the boats. The largest fleet ever assembled in the history of Homo sapiens, the largest fleet for the next 300 years, in fact, was burned to the ground because the emperor said, "We need no contact with the rest of the world. We're number one." And what happened in the Muslim world? Well, the prime minister of Malaysia wrote an essay once where he laid it out. He, a Muslim, was ashamed of the fact that 1,000 years ago there was a debate, a very big debate within the highest circles of the Muslim religion, about where does truth come from. There were two positions. One position said that truth comes from nature, therefore we should study it, and that's called science. The other group said no. You see, Allah is above nature. He can change nature when he feels like. He's not a prisoner of nature like we are. He can change nature. Therefore, there's no point learning nature because it could be changed at any point, and therefore the Quran is a source of all knowledge. Well, guess who won that argument? For the next 1,000 years. Because if you look at space, look at the names of the stars, Algol, Altair, they're Arabic. Because guess who named most of the stars in the heavens? Or algebra. Guess where that word comes from? And guess what happened to the great Muslim world? Well, there's a lesson here, obviously. And the lesson is, you can ignore science all you want. You can snicker, you can laugh, you can giggle at science all you want. You're just going to be poor, that's all. You will be poor, powerless, and you'll wonder, how come they're so rich over there? How come I'm so poor? Think about that. When you travel around the world and you meet different societies and you wonder, gee, how come certain societies are richer than other societies? Well, find out. Get a copy of my book, Physics of the Future, a whole chapter interviewing some of the great economists of the world about where wealth comes from. And get a copy for $100 of Explorations, an archive on MP3. And so once again, call the number 516-620-3602 and say, "I believe in the mission of Radio WBAI. I believe in free speech, community-based radio, WBAI. And that's why I'm taking out my credit card and calling 516-620-3602 and pledging to keep WBAI alive, healthy, and well. And once again, for an $80 pledge, you can get a copy of Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Lives by the Year 2100. For a $100 pledge, you can get previous editions of Explorations, which airs every Saturday at 2 o'clock on Radio WBAI. Well, without further ado, let's go now to the next segment, where once again our special guest is Patrick Tucker. We are talking about your future, not the future in the abstract. We're talking about the future of your children and your future. Let's have the next interview. Okay, Patrick, we talked about the smart house, computers of the future. We talked about medicine and how your bathroom will have more computer power than a modern university hospital. And now let's talk about robots. We are brainwashed by Hollywood into thinking that thinking, scheming, devious robots are just around the corner. Skynet is going to become conscious, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, the robot, is going to be unleashed on humanity. But tell us a little bit about robots today, where we really are with respect to creating automata, machines that can think by themselves. And let's now think about the next 50 to 100 years. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that, robot development is proceeding a lot faster than many people thought it would. But if you talk to roboticists, one of their main concerns is that people have put too much faith in these devices to act autonomously. Because as you pointed out, they are they're wondrous machines, and they're able to do a lot of things a lot better than they used to. But they are still dumb machines. There's two tracks of robot development in many ways. There's the type of robot or artificial intelligence that you saw on Jeopardy with Watson, and this is a computer that's been programmed to execute a really difficult command, which is playing Jeopardy and understanding and parsing nuances in language and understanding a bit about the way humans speak and taking that information and dialoguing with a huge storehouse of information to basically beat humans at what is considered an extremely human game, which is Jeopardy. Everyone who saw Watson win on Jeopardy knows that the performance was really quite remarkable and represents a huge improvement over where artificial intelligence was a couple of years ago. But this is still a limited artificial intelligence. This Watson's not necessarily going to compete with you for your job. After Deep Blue, which was Watson's predecessor, another IBM artificial intelligence computer program, beat Garry Kasparov in chess in the 80s, the literary critic George Plimpton had a wonderful observation. He said, yeah, that thing's great at chess, but it can't hail a cab to get out of the hotel room. It's not going to help you with a bad marriage. And the same is true with Watson. So that's a particular type of artificial intelligence, and it's limited to performing perhaps extremely complex tasks really well, but it may not know as much about the real world as it seems to, or that we think that it does.
Now, Patrick, this Watson computer, wasn't it so stupid that it didn't even know that it won? You couldn't congratulate it. You couldn't say, wow, you just won this contest against two humans. Isn't this basically just a very sophisticated adding machine?
Well, I think that you can certainly say that it's a lot cooler than an adding machine, but no, it couldn't understand the concept of winning. It's not going to know meaningfully what it means to sort of conquer this particular conquest. There's no consequence for it. It just executes a program. So yes, I mean, it's a fantastic adding machine. The more interesting work in robotics and artificial intelligence, from my perspective, is actually taking place in Japan, from which I just returned. They're spending a lot of time trying to create robots that interact with people and in many ways do a lot of the functions in three-dimensional space that people do. Now, the robots right now are still extremely rudimentary. They've got a robot that can fold laundry, and they've got robots that can do interesting traditional Japanese dances, and it's still really rudimentary, but that avenue of robotic development where you're forcing the robot to interact with three-dimensional space, I think is going to be the much more lucrative one, because that's how our brains developed. We developed our brain to perceive patterns in three-dimensional space, avoid threats, and seek out opportunities. And so in Japan, one thing that they're really focused on is getting robots to sort of navigate the same things, because they have a very elderly population, and they hope that robots will be able to help elderly people in their homes to do more things. But that avenue of research is yielding some really remarkable results. These are still, of course, dumb machines, but you can see them learning more about the actual world than I think you would see in a machine like Watson, which has been programmed with all the information that it has.
Okay, well, let's talk about these two kinds of robots. First of all, the first type of robot is sometimes called an expert system. It has a lot of facts, just a lot of facts. It can't reason. It can't come to conclusions. It can't do anything that we associate with thinking, but it's very good at correlating facts and giving you answers for well-defined questions. So, some people think that one day we're going to have RoboDoc or RoboLawyer. We'll simply talk to the wall, an animated image of a doctor or lawyer will appear. You'll ask questions in a stylized format, And 95, 99% of the time, common questions will get an accurate answer. So do you foresee a time when the descendants of Watson eventually become our expert companions that can answer questions like in medicine, in law, and things like that?
Well, I think that a lot of people are already using search engines like Google as their expert companion. And this is a form of, in many ways, an expert system that's just an algorithm. The data that it's giving is data that's been human supplied, but we still trust it as though it were checked and the result of a thought process that is objective, when of course it isn't. So I think that there's a lot of room for different expert systems to perhaps make many different professions obsolete as we understand them today. These expert systems, they're also sometimes called narrow artificial intelligences, because they can—they are artificially intelligent, but only along in a very narrow definition. They're only good at one particular thing. They are incapable of stuff like creativity or thinking sort of outside of the box. So you might be able to use them as a reference, and they'll be a fantastic reference, and we can. This will save a lot of time that we would otherwise spend looking things up or searching through, for instance, Google search engine results for the correct answer. That process is going to get a lot easier because of these expert systems. But they're not going, if you ask them to sort of speculate about the meaning of something, they might not give you the answer that's going to be optimal. I think that at least for the next 50 years, you're still going to need to take that data and ask a real expert about what it might mean and how they might use it or how you might use it most productively in order to get your best answer.
Yeah, some people think that perhaps 90% of the visits to the doctor and to the hospital are just for small little menial things, but they rack up a huge bill when you simply add up all the hours devoted to it. And that's where RoboDoc and RoboLawyer come in, not for the specialized cases involving very sophisticated use of surgery and high tech, but just for the day-to-day coughs and the day-to-day fevers and the day-to-day things that drive many people to the hospital and to the doctor's office. And now, speaking about the second kind of robot, you touched upon something. The Japanese population is aging faster than any other population on the planet Earth right now. Birth rates are plunging down to about 1.2 children per family. Almost no immigration into Japan is taking place. And so aren't we seeing basically an enormous push into robotics to create robot nurses to take care of a very aging population?
Yes, yes, you are. And nursing is one potential use of these robots. In the interim, I think they're looking at them more sort of like companions, sort of like maids. But ultimately, they will have to perform very low-level sort of medical tasks. And the robotic development and robotic research in Japan is different from the United States in a couple of respects. On the one hand, as you mentioned, there's tremendous demographic need. They are the oldest population on the planet demographically, with the exception of Monaco, which doesn't exactly count, I don't think. And so there's tremendous need for servants in houses that can do little things that people who are old used to be able to do fairly well but can't anymore. The work situation in Japan is such that people are really expected to be to work. There's no working from home isn't something socially that's nearly as acceptable as it is in the United States. But more importantly, robotic development in Japan is funded not by the military as it is in the United States. I mean, there are private companies that do robotic development in the States, but a lot of the money going into that development is military money. In Japan, a lot of that money comes from grants. It comes from the government, and but not through the military, and it comes from big corporations. And so the field of robotic research is open in a different way. I talked to a robotic researcher over there. His name is Dylan Gass. He works with the Advanced Telecommunications Research Institute, and he pointed out that they have a very different legal system over there as well. So you can actually put people and robots together, like actual civilians. Regular people that like go out and walk around malls and drive cars, and you know, you and I, we're going to have a much higher likelihood of being able to interact with a robot in Japan than we would in the United States, because Here, if you want to put a robot, for instance, in a mall, you need a lot of permits and you could get sued if one of the actuators misfires and, you know, you've got a hydraulic pump going, you know, moving towards somebody's head at 200 miles an hour, that's a lawsuit. Whereas in Japan, people are much more likely to, the legal environment is such that you don't have to worry as much about lawsuits. So they're running a really interesting experiment over there where they have a bunch of robots in an Osaka shopping mall. They just concluded this experiment in December. And if you walk through the mall, the robot takes a look at how fast you're walking, whether you're lingering by the windows, whether you're lingering by the map, and what your body language seems to be. They pick up all this information from a network of sensors that are placed around this particular area, and based on the information that it receives, it makes a determination about whether or not you're safe to approach or whether you're in a hurry. And if you're safe to approach, the robot walks up to you and gives you directions about or makes a recommendation for a shop that you might like to see. It's exactly the sort of thing that you wouldn't find in the United States for legal reasons, but in Japan you can run an experiment like that, and it's really quite fascinating. And this is why I think the greatest strides that we're going to see in robotics are going to be based out of Japan in the next 10
years. And you've been listening to WBAI's Exploration. This is Dr. Michio Kaku. I'm a professor of theoretical physics right here at the City College of New York. And I'm here because we have to raise money for your favorite radio station. Normally, my show airs every Saturday at 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock. We discuss cutting-edge science with Nobel Prize winners, directors of major laboratories, about science issues that affect your life and your children's life. But now we have a special edition of Exploration from 7 to 9, where we're going to talk about the future of your children, your future of medicine, jobs, space travel, biotech, artificial intelligence, all of that contained in my book, Physics of the Future. For an $80 pledge, you can help keep WBAI alive and well. For an $80 pledge, you get a copy of Physics of the Future, 6 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny and Our Lives by the Year 2100. And for a $100 pledge, you can get previous editions of Exploration. Like I said, every Saturday from 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock, I'm here right on WBAI talking about your future. Well, previous editions of Exploration are on an archive on a flash drive, and you can get a copy for a $100 pledge. And that's if you call 516-620-3602. Once again, 516-620-3602. And first of all, I'd like to thank Corinne Wellinger for making a pledge to get a copy of Physics of the Future. We've also had other pledges from New York getting the flash drive and the book, or the flash drive, or just a listener who wants to make a pledge of $10 to this radio station. Now, remember, we depend on you. You are the listener. We don't get a dime from corporate America. We don't get a dime from petrochemical industry, aerospace industry. We depend upon you. And without you, the listener, we're nothing, literally. It means we can't pay the bills. We can't pay the staff. We can't pay for the rent. We can't pay for the antenna on the Empire State Building. And look, let's be blunt about this. We had a near-death experience. We came very close to losing our perch on top of the Empire State Building. You know what that means? We broadcast at 50,000 watts. That's huge. That sends a signal out to 90 miles in all direction. I've been on many radio stations that have a signal of 5,000 watts. We're 10 times bigger, and we're in the middle of the FM dial. And if we were ever to lose that signal, that's for keeps. We'd never be able to cough up the, what, $50 million it would take to get that license back again. That's why we're depending on the cavalry. We're depending upon you. Maybe you know a child who's just beginning to show an interest in science, just beginning to be fascinated by space travel and science fiction movies, and wants to know everything about the world around them. This book is for them. Or maybe you have a loved one who's just out of work right now, looking for a job, but is smart enough to realize that, hey, they don't want to graduate from the community college right into the unemployment line. They want to graduate into the future. What jobs are going to flourish in the future? Find out by getting a copy of Physics of the Future. Or maybe you know someone who's sick. someone who has a problem with a medical ailment that requires state-of-the-art diagnostics. Find out about the state of biotech. Find out about where medicine is going by getting a copy of Physics of the Future. Or maybe you know a space buff who wants to know, are we really going to go to Mars? What about the moon? What about going beyond to the asteroid belt? Find out by getting a copy of Physics of the Future. And why should you do that? First of all, I've had the privilege of interviewing over 300 of the world's top scientists for Exploration, but also for BBC Television, the Discovery Channel, and the Science Channel. I've had the privilege of taking a film crew right to the laboratories and filming the scientists who are doing research on invisibility, on time travel, on teleportation, building starships. I've had the rare privilege of taking a video camera and putting them on national television. Well, why don't you benefit from all this rich body of knowledge? Get a copy of Physics of the Future, yours for $80. In fact, my publisher, Doubleday, has been so generous as to donate copies to WBAI to make sure that WBAI raises money. And once again, you can also, for a $100 pledge, get copies of previous editions of Explorations, which airs every 2 o'clock here on Radio WBAI. And so once again, write this number down, 516-620-3602, and get your copy of The Future. Physics of the Future, yours for $80. And Explorations with Dr. Michio Kaku, an archive on a flash drive for a $100 pledge. And realize that your money goes 10 times the distance if you were to donate to any other group. We don't have fact-finding junkets to Hawaii. We don't have a flower budget. We don't pad our payrolls. We are right down to the bone. In fact, many of our staff members haven't been paid at all in the last month. That's how dire the situation is. And from my point of view, well, I do everything for free. I don't get one dime from this radio station. In fact, I produce the show myself. I buy all the equipment myself. I pay for all the travel expenses myself, all the telephone bills. Hey, that adds up. But I do it because I believe in WBAI. And what I'm asking you is, do you believe? Do you believe in WBAI? Do you believe that you should get to the telephone and call 516-620-3602 and pledge to keep this radio station alive? A $25 pledge will get you a membership right into Pacifica. $80 pledge, you'll get a copy of my book, Physics of the Future, New York Times bestseller, 6 weeks on the bestseller list, and Explorations, a flash drive with archives of previous programs. So why don't you give the gift of the future to a loved one, someone who's out of work and wants to know what are the jobs of the future, someone who is ill and wants to know what medicine can do, medicine of the future, someone who's curious and wants to know, hey, what's out there for a young child just beginning to learn about the space program, fascinated by science fiction? Or maybe you're an inventor and you want to know what's happening with invisibility research, teleportation, building starships. Or maybe you're an economist and you want to know what other economists think about concerning where wealth comes from. Which countries are going to be rich in the future? Which countries are going to be poor? Find out, because this book is based on interviews with over 300 of the world's top scientists. In fact, I list about 200 of them in the preface of the book. These are the people who are inventing the future in their laboratory. Okay, what I'd like you to do now is continue with our interview with Patrick Tucker. Also, we're going to be bringing on a Princeton professor in a few more moments who'll talk to us about time machines, what it would take to build a working time machine. But let's continue now with the next segment where we continue discussion of the future. Well, Patrick, we talked about robots, and now let's talk about science fiction. Sometime in the future, some people think that the robots may take over. Maybe they'll become smarter than us. Maybe they'll put us in zoos. Maybe they'll throw peanuts at us, make us dance behind bars, just like we make bears dance behind bars. Other people say that, well, let them take over. They are our children. It's the natural progress of evolution, survival of the fittest. And if they're fitter than us, well, they are our children. And if they put us to rest, so be it. Well, what are your thoughts? You probably get a lot of different thoughts from all directions. First of all, tell us, what is the singularity, and what do you think is going to actually happen?
Well, the singularity is a term from physics, pointing to an event horizon where, because of an accelerating event, there's a point where you can multiply something over and over and over again, and for a number of cycles in that multiplication, you get very low numbers, but you reach a point where the multiplying a number by over and over again, you suddenly get really large numbers.